Welcome to the Future of Pharma with ISPU Boston, where I talk to the thought leaders of the pharmaceutical industry about where our industry is headed and what you can do about it. I'm your host, Samir Gondalia. Thanks for joining us today.
My guest today is Matt Roberge. He got his mechanical engineering degree from Villanova University. He currently works for Pfizer and serves as a senior director of Global Technology Network and Emerging Market. He has a truly global organization with teams in the USA, China, Russia, Argentina, Brazil, India, and I'm sure I'm forgetting a couple. I had the pleasure of working under Matt's leadership when Pfizer built the first Asian Biologics Development Center in Hangzhou, China, a few years back. He's someone I'd call on for advice anytime, and we had a great time recording this interview. Hope you enjoy it too. Here's Matt Roberge from Pfizer.
Hi, Matt. How are you doing today?
Doing well, Samir. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us. So first of all, walk us through your journey from being a mechanical engineer where you were designing and building facilities to doing biotechnology and biologic stuff in emerging market. And if you can give us a brief skinny about your global organization and kind of modalities you deal with so our listeners can get some idea about your organization and your school.
Okay, great. Thanks. I get that question a lot more now that I'm older, so it's one that I've answered a few times now. I don't know that I could replicate my journey from mechanical engineer to where I am now. I think it's a series of saying yes at the right time and understanding or maybe even guessing that an opportunity seemed pretty well. And you say yes and you dive in and you don't look back. But I had started out at an engineering firm. From there, I wanted to move closer to manufacturing, but it's tough to go from a firm into manufacturing directly. So after having built a couple of pharmaceutical plants in a contract capacity, I had the resume that you needed to get into a manufacturing role. I'm still engineering related, but in a manufacturing company. Of course, it has a lot to do with who you know.
Right.
So having a boss that moved in front of me and ultimately pulled me into my first job at a manufacturing company paved that way. And then from there, generally, it's just a matter of saying yes. I think people too often think about every little detail and how this move is going to affect my career and how that move is going to, and what happens if I come back and how is it. You can't think too much about it, is my own personal experience. If at an intuitive level, an opportunity sounds right and it seems like it's something you want to do and is generally going to make you happy, I think you jump in and do it. And my career has been kind of an exercise in that.
So if it's not going to kill you, it's going to make you stronger?
Absolutely. I'm a big believer in Nishi. I definitely believe that. So I said yes a lot. And things go for a long period of time. I was an engineer building plants for probably 8 years. A couple of times something would come up and it didn't quite feel right. And I just, no, I'm happy doing what I'm doing. I'll stay doing that. And then at some point, this is something I really want to do and it seems to fit. And you just jump in and go for it. So I went from engineering into technology with the vaccines. Our company got bought in whatever that was, 2009, I guess. And from there, you sort of have new people, new experiences. Everything's reset. So that was kind of a cool experience. Right. And you don't realize how much you've learned and gained in terms of knowledge and experience until new people are around taking assessment of people. But you sort of just jump in those opportunities as they come up. The vaccine background and going from a moderate sized company to a global company was really the kind of step change for me in my career.
So from Wyeth to Pfizer.
Yes. Right. Yeah. I thought Wyeth was a big company.
Yeah, same here.
Until we were.
Well, I thought Genetics was a big company, but.
And it blows you away. Like every step change, you right. think, I really didn't anticipate that an organization could be this big. But Pfizer's global reach took the experience that I have in a very different direction. But Pfizer's got the ability to move stuff all over the place that some of the smaller companies didn't, which opened up a bunch of doors for someone like me with my experience. I knew how to do things, but there wasn't necessarily an outlet for that at a smaller company. If you go to work for a company like Pfizer that's got such a reach and such a commercial enterprise around the globe, there's bunches of places that don't have what you know, and that presented the opportunity and led to tech transfer and emerging markets and all the other stuff.
So which brings to the next part. So tell us about your organization's geographical reach and what kind of modalities your group deals with?
That's an interesting question. So we were acquired, and a lot of the expertise at Wyeth was in the United States, and the aspiration of Pfizer was to take a lot of that product. And by government policy in a lot of other countries, you have to deal in those geographies. Hmm. It's not practical to do that from within the United States, but that's where our experience was. So it took a little bit of time, but over I don't know, I'd say maybe 5 years or so, very much opportunistically, we started to cross-train and move some of that experience and knowledge to the emerging markets, which is where we're really going after with our, right, our tech transfers. And that gave us the global reach. And I think now that we have that, it's such a natural fit for a global company. And we always joke, the sun doesn't set in our organization. somewhere in the world, right, someone on my team is working.
Right.
And it's a little bit troubling at some point in time because you have to work around time zones and you have a lot of early and late calls. But it's also nice. You can go to bed and leave something with someone and get up in the morning and the work is done.
Right.
So we're spread. I don't think of the globe so much in terms of countries, but I think of it in terms of time zones, mm-hmm, because you can work vertically in a time zone very seamlessly. You can call people during normal business hours. You can get a few people on the phone. It's a lot more natural. But we've got people pretty much that can cover a working day 24
And you can hours. Get you can very quickly get used to having a 9 p.m. or 6 a.m. meetings.
It doesn't... I don't know if you get used to it. But you're... And just to come back to your modalities question.
Yes.
I think the globe is fairly saturated with small molecules, especially solid dosage. That technology is a bit dated. And there's still some new things out there to be sure. But the pull is really in two areas I'm seeing, in aseptic manufacturing, which is a lot of human intelligence. There's a lot of details in aseptic manufacturing that people need to get right over and over and over again. So that's sort of a critical mass of expertise that doesn't necessarily move well. So that's definitely an area of interest that we're seeing around the globe. The other area is obviously biotech, which I'm including vaccines in that. There's a humongous pull for that.
Right, right. There is explosive scientific and innovation growth going on in biotechs. About your global organization, just for our listeners. So you had a team in China, which I'm part of, and Argentina, South Africa, and which island?
India. Ireland, Italy, Brazil.
Russia,
Turkey, United Arab Emirates.
Oh, good. Is that a new one?
That is. And I feel like I'm probably missing one or two, but that's more or less covers it, yeah.
Now, when you...
The United States.
Right. That's at college, really. You have people in college.
Pennsylvania. Yeah.
Now, when you work with teams from different countries and different cultures, what are the soft skills you need? And do you have any interesting observations that when you work with people from different cultures, you need to approach the same thing in a different way? And how does that impact the business decisions?
I kind of waver on that a lot. So on one hand, I would say I don't change my approach. I think the one thing that I found consistently true around the globe, no matter what country, language I'm working in, manufacturing people are cut from the same cloth.
Right, right.
They get up in the morning, they deal with a bunch of very difficult things, nothing ever works right, and they're just unbelievably driven to deal with reality and get product out the door. And I've yet to see a different example of that. So in that sense, I think there's a lot of commonality. I had an experience one time quite a while ago driving through an extremely rural section of China. It was one of my first trips there, so I was kind of absorbing a lot of cultural differences, and they're obvious in China as compared to the U.S. But I saw a little boy, and he didn't have any clothes on. He was like running around just playing outside, and his father was there, you know, kind of working around in a field or something like that. And someone commented how different things were in the U.S. versus China. And I said, not really. That dad's worried about exactly the same things for his kids that I'm worried about for mine. You know, yeah. He's worried about making sure he's got enough to eat and that he's comfortable and his future is... Yeah, exactly. So it's the same stuff I worry about. So it's not that different. The details are a lot different. But in that sense, I think people in human nature are generally consistent around the globe. A lot of different know, colors and flavors, but in that sense, the same.
Right. But for things like saying Germany, when they say the meeting will start at 9:00, the meeting starts at 9:00. But in India, that's just a suggestion. It's like the cable guy's window. The meeting will start between 9 and 11.
In that sense, how business is done and executed,
right,
in business culture, there are a lot of differences. So I think
things still get done. Like nobody misses the deadline. Plans still get done, and you know all those things sell. But day to day, different nuances.
They're enormous. I think probably the country that I have, I think, is the biggest challenge. I'll put it that way. Is Russia, and it's a bit deceiving. I think that's the kind of challenge with Russia. If you're again American perspective, but as an American going into Russia, it looks like Western Europe. And you know, I think Western Europe and the U.S. work very well together. The cultures are extremely close. And it's easy for Europeans and Americans to work, you know, seamlessly together. And we've gotten over, you know, kind of some of the cultural differences a long, long time ago.
We had our plants in Ireland.
It's not a big deal.
Right. Belgium.
You go into Russia. Russia looks like Western Europe. You know, the people look like us. Like obviously, they speak a different language, but the architecture is a bit different, but the cities kind of look and feel like a Western European city. So you're sort of lulled into a false sense of I'm familiar with this environment.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get into business negotiations and it's a very different way of doing things. So Americans tend to use contracts as a rainy day thing. You know, if something goes wrong after the lawyers negotiate the contract, right, you go get it and start kind of looking through, you know, where you're exposed, what you have to do, that kind of thing. In Russia, the contract is a daily part of business.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, they're quoting chapter and verse. And it's brutal. It is really brutal.
It must be a little bit slow, too,
I'll say it's a very high horsepower. If you want it to go fast, yeah, it's going to take a lot of horsepower. And I've yet to experience fast in Russia because there is a lot of arguing and a lot of drama, a lot of banging at the table. And so, yeah, and it's cultural.
Right.
It's, you could, at the end of the day, you go out and you have a great dinner. Yeah, you have a few drinks with your counterparts and everyone's laughing and having a good time. But then the next day you're back at it and it's very serious business and no one's smiling again.
So you have to factor in that extra time to get things done, for example, I guess.
And in anxiety.
From business point of view. Right.
And I think if you're a Russian working in Russia, that you understand that's just how things are done. If you're an American, you're very taken back by this brutal emphasis on the contract and whose responsibility is what, and you were supposed to do this. And it feels very much like you're arguing in a legal way just for normal day-to-day things. But otherwise, I think if you focus on function and objectives and common goals and that sort of thing, even with, you know, working with Russia, those things I think are pretty easy to manage. And then there are lots of nuances. There's a lot of cultural differences, obviously, between China and the U.S. and India and the U.S., but from my perspective, I think that's what makes the job fun.
Yeah, yeah.
If I get in a plane and travel 14 hours, it better be different than what I'm doing in the U.S. or I'm going to be ticked off. It's boring otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's true. That's so true. The other thing that what you and I were talking about earlier is that our industry is becoming a pharma without borders. It is becoming less and less relevant where the company is located, where you're making your drug substance, where you do drug product. The important thing that is becoming is that you make useful medicine and how to get to the patients cheaply, fast, and without compromising the quality. And as I was saying, it's becoming less and less important where it's made. So what are your thoughts on that subject where geographically it's going to be like companies like Pfizer and Novartis, it doesn't matter where we make the stuff. We just care about how it's made and, you know, we are meeting all the regulations. What are your thoughts on this, the pharma without borders and not having to deal with the entities that separate them?
Yeah, my view of borders in general is they exist to define who pays taxes to who. Right, so
true.
I think when I look at, I saw an article a couple of years ago. It was written by a consultant and it had to do with the demographics in the pharmaceutical industry. As I recall, I can't think of it exactly, but I think the person that wrote it was from Germany and he was kind of editorializing on Europe and the United States and observing that demographically we're getting old as an industry.
And this was for the healthcare.
This is for healthcare.
Okay.
It's for healthcare. So, and he had a bunch of stats and graphs and data. You know, it wasn't just his opinion. He had a lot of data on it. But the key was, it was within the borders of a bunch of European countries in the United States. So I thought he's not commenting on our industry, he's commenting on those countries.
Right. It's a big world outside of America and Europe.
Why are we defining borders in those countries? There are lots of smart people with great education, great experience, great knowledge outside of those countries. And who said we have to import those people into those countries in order for them to work in our industry? And, you know, I look at our company and it's very obvious when you get on any of our telephone calls, we'll have, you know, people from six time zones in seven countries on a call and don't even think twice about it.
Right.
So I would challenge the assumption that we're getting old. If you look at certain countries, those countries are getting old, that's for sure. But I don't think that the industry is. And I think that, at least from my own experience, we're working seamlessly across the globe every day. And we just take it for granted now as a way of doing work. So I wouldn't draw those distinctions. I think the borders thing was something artificial. If I look at a different perspective in terms of development, my review might be a little bit less rosy in that I do think the United States and Europe tends to drive what's developed because of economic reasons. So development costs a lot of money. You need money to go get those and you need to provide a return on investment. So you're going to tend to develop things that are going to have a big ROI. There's an article written a bunch of years ago called Desperately Seeking Cures that covered this. Mm-hmm. Really well written, great article. And essentially what it said was big GDP countries drive what's developed and then people don't get interested in the things that low GDP countries might need. And it's obvious the disease burden is a little bit different. Unfortunately, about 85% of the world's population lives in those places. So I think that the industry needs to fix that, in so much as if private industry doesn't address the need for low-cost medicines to treat disease burden in those countries that's not disease burden or very low disease burden in the Western higher GDP countries, that something's going to happen where the government starts to do it or it's going to be taken out of private industry's hands. And I think none of us are going to be happy if that happens. Yeah. So we would be well advised as an industry to figure out an answer to how to do that. So in my mind, you either do the development and accept that a certain amount of development isn't going to provide the same return on investment, or you give the whatever knowledge you have on something like Ebola or dengue or something like that. See, this is how you do development. We're going to give it to you and, you know, have at it in terms of developing it, but it's going to mean something to scientists who live in Ethiopia or India, perhaps, where dengue is a big thing, any of those tropical environments. Yes. So I would give away what we have if we're not willing to develop it. But I think science in some nation stage is doing no one any good on a bench in the US or Europe if we don't figure out how to bring it to patients that need it.
Right, right. Now, I mean, that's what we always say, that our mission is to help patients. And at the end of the day, if you have science and know-how, but if it's not reaching the right patients and it's not helping, and God knows our industry can use some goodwill from public right now. Now, we talked about the biologics and small molecule. I think, you know, your organization is dealing with both. One trend we have seen in last 10 years is, well, in last 5 years, there is no separation between pharmaceutical and biopharma. When Pfizer bought over Wyeth, we were Wyeth Biopharma. There was a clear distinction, right? And now with all the mergers and acquisitions, each big pharma company is dealing with small molecules and biologics, which means they're moving people around. So what kind of soft skills or knowledge that somebody from small molecule can take it to biologics or vice versa, and how can that person have a new career in new modalities, and how can company can use the talent at its disposal?
And so I'll give sort of a technical answer, then maybe more of a general one. That in a technical sense, like basic GMP operations, that those are common.
Right, regulatory filings and
there's a sequence to it.
Investigation, engineering,
If you think as a technical person, the ideas cross over. Now, you do have to step away from some of the specifics. You don't use bioequivalent studies in biologics so much. It's a lot less meaning, but it's a big deal in small molecules to prove some equivalency and that kind of thing. But other than that, the idea is the same, that you've got to demonstrate some equivalency back to some standard, and that you've got to have validated protocols that go from here to here. So all those concepts kind of cross over. And I think that's sort of the cost of entry. So if you're going to work in pharmaceuticals, you have to learn our vernacular. You can learn it in either biologics or small molecules, but someplace you got to learn it. So in that sense, those things cross over. Plus, biologics, we think we're a lot smarter, and we have bigger words and different things. But if
you have to impress people, you know, when I go to parties and I say, well, someone asks me, what do you do? And I say, I'm a biotech scientist. And that's pretty much end of the conversation. Like the person doesn't know what to ask next.
Yeah. And I think it's unfortunate. We're doing ourselves a disservice, really.
Right.
You can explain things and, you know, it's not like oscillation, it's sugar. You know right. what I mean? Like you can explain things in terms people can equate, even if it's a little bit not quite right. so right. But I think having a bigger group of people understand what we do is really important, because if it's just that witchcraft behind the curtain, they never really understand what they're getting from all the hardcore science. They just know it's neat, but it's scary and expensive, and I don't really want to know. And I think what we do, like, we should be really proud of what we do.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that technology piece is probably an element of marketing that we can do. And I think it comes back to some of the leadership and people-related things. And I'll go back even further in my career when I used to work in just pure chemicals, paper mills, refineries, that kind of thing. Very hardcore engineering, really hardcore engineering. And it's more the type of stuff that you learned in class, thermodynamics and fluids, and the words were all the same because pharma's got a completely different vernacular. So I had to make the transition from heavy industry into pharma, and I didn't know anything. I messed up so many things, it was unbelievable.
Did your bosses know at that time you didn't know anything?
They did.
Okay.
That's why I went to work for it.
You still survived.
I did. I went to work for an engineering company for a chemical job. That got canceled, and I ended up tucked in sort of below the radar screen at a pharma job. And I thought, no self-respecting engineer would ever work in pharmaceuticals. I can't wait to get out. Here I am, 30-some-odd years later. But I was kind of hidden for a while, and apparently I did some things right. But I messed up some validation protocols so bad, it was unbelievable. But as you go through that, I think you learn softer skills. And the big thing is you learn how to apply knowledge. So just because there's a very specific set of standards around one thing doesn't mean it only applies to that. You may have to translate and move some ideas into a different thing, but you start to see patterns. So if you have a technical mind and you know how to structure certain things, you'll see patterns that start to repeat, especially with people and leadership things. And that's where I think the learning kind of builds upon itself. And my dad told me once upon a time, no experience is a bad experience.
Right. At least you'll know what not to do, right?
And it's true. So, yeah, I think things build, you get interested in stuff, and it all starts to appeal. The one thing I'll say, I've had the benefit of working around some really smart people.
Mm-hmm.
So I ask a lot of questions.
Why, I know some why, of those why? Smart people.
Yeah, maybe you know some of them pretty well. But I never hesitated to ask. And I think one of the critical points in my career was I was sitting kind of quiet in a meeting one day with vaccines. So this was one of my other transitions from small molecules into biologics. And I had a bunch of questions in my head about what the subject matter of the meeting was. But I thought, oh, I'm not really, you know, an expert like all these guys are at this stuff. So I'm just going to sit here being quiet. And at some point in time, it became obvious everybody else had the same questions. So then you get confident enough to start asking them. And then people think like, man, that guy's really smart. Look at all the questions he's asking. Those are really good points. And truth be, I was, is, you know, kind of in the dark as everybody else. The only difference was I asked a question and other people didn't. Yeah.
We were talking about earlier. So we talked about this, you know, small molecule biologics and new technology and all that stuff. And we always say that the sellers are always selling the features, and the buyers are always buying benefits, right? And we buy all this new technology and we build these plants. What are your thoughts about features and benefits in the pharma industry? We come across so many new technologies. You have a problem, you're looking for solutions, you need technological solutions, but someone sends you something and it doesn't appeal to you, even though it might solve your problem.
This is fantastic. I cover this routinely and it over and over and over again as a development opportunity for technical people. And we talked about this a little while ago, that we undersell ourselves in biotech with all the fancy words and language and complicated things. And to be fair, it is complicated. But you sort of want that appreciation in society. And like, do you really know what we do? They're never going to understand it if you use these huge words. So people want to know how things benefit them.
Mm.
And technical guys love talking about details.
Like specs. And
it's stainless steel, and it's got so much nickel and chrome, and you know, the column is 2 meters. Patients don't care about any of that stuff. Does it make my illness go away, or does it not make my illness go away? Commercial people, is it going to make me money? Am I going to sell more drugs, or is it not? But that's what people care about. So I think as a technical discipline, and I'm passionate, by the way, about engineering and scientists and kind of what we do for the world. I think we're very undersold as a profession, and people kind of generally don't get us, and we probably don't really get other people for that matter. But I just think that we don't sell ourselves well, but it's because we're so fascinated with details and features, stainless, shiny lights, size of columns, whatever. And we don't understand that no one else really cares about that stuff. Yeah. What they want to know is, what does it do for me?
Right.
And all of the other stuff is unimportant. So I think the people who move from a technical career into bigger positions of leadership and enterprise management have figured out the ability of saying, these are the things that are technically cool because we know they do something to help people, but they've figured out how to describe them in such a way that other people, non-technical people, can understand what it is that it's doing to help them.
And that is so true. I think that the pharma industry itself as a whole can also use some of that to communicate the message to the public. We always, you know, we make medicines that save lives and takes away pain. We should be able to communicate to the people without complicating the message with the jargon and, you know, making it more confusing than it already is.
So you had a great story in that, Samir, that smallpox, the development of that vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
You can Google it. This is all stuff that's been around for a long time. But Edward Jenner, the guy that's generally credited with that vaccine. And there was research, I think it's far back, it's like the 1400s, that they've been able to understand from China, actually, where they were dabbling in the form of rudimentary vaccination. But he's the one that observed the correlation between milkmaids and milkmaids not getting smallpox back in the 1700s. So this is the part that just fascinates me. And he drew the correlation. If you get cowpox, evidently, for some reason, didn't know why, you won't get smallpox.
Mm-hmm.
So he talked some kid's mother into getting that kid sick. I think it was the gardener's son, if I'm not mistaken. But some kid's mother, back when this was epidemic and people were dying of smallpox, he talked that mother into infecting the kid with cowpox, number one. And then the story was something like, trust me, we'll expose him to smallpox and he won't get sick.
Uh-huh.
All before...
It sounds like the first vaccine of the world.
It was generally credited as the first. And of course, you know what happened.
Right.
It was successful, and then
yeah.
a bunch of other things happened. And the cool part was, from a science and technology standpoint, it didn't really change much until like after 1986. Like, we kind of stuck with that process for so long.
Yeah.
But I just think, in terms of that person's ability to sell,
connect the dots,
microbiology, talking to a kid's mother, the first clinical trial ever. Trust me, we're going to get your kid sick and then expose him to this deadly disease and everything's going to be fine. And she did it, and thank God she did. You know, the disease is more or less eradicated.
So you had a pretty long career. What are your most satisfying accomplishments? Something you're very proud of?
It's a good question. I've been fortunate to have quite a few of those that I can look back at and really hang my hat on. I think the Prevnar vaccine, anyone who touched that, is just enormously proud of what we did. The kids who didn't die because of that vaccine.
When I took my kids for the vaccination, you know, you have two kids. The doctor shows you the Prevnar vial and shows you the expiry date. And it's a Prevnar. And I said, yeah, we make that in Endover, part of that. And that felt so good, that we make something and my kids were getting vaccinated with Prevnar. So,
and yeah, the way I think about it, and not being disparaging of medical doctors, but there's 24 hours a day a medical doctor can affect an outcome on a patient at a certain rate per, you know, so many patients per hour, multiplied by the number of days the doctor works, multiplies by the guy's whole career. That's some number.
Right.
And it's phenomenal work. It's hands-on, like the interpersonal interaction, I'm sure, a very rewarding career. In our case, We don't know the patients that we've affected. We don't know who got sick and didn't get sick. We don't know who didn't die.
30 million kids every year get Prevnar, and we don't know any of them.
We don't know any of them. But think of the number of kids that didn't die because of the vaccine that we made. And that, for me, you know, if my career only accomplished that, I would feel very good about what I did. And then, you know, if I look at some of the things that we've done, and I've maybe had a little bit more of a personal contact with the work that we're doing in China and bringing oncology to a bunch of patients that wouldn't otherwise have access to that kind of, you know, very modern, very high quality biologic medication, you know, that was ours. You know,
right.
That idea started with us. It was our plan. We executed it. We're at the, you know, late stages of the project now. So that one, probably a little bit more of a personal touch on that one.
That one's pretty rewarding too. At our Hangzhou site, they have a small model of the plant. And I can point at drug substance building and say, I helped build that. And it feels so good that, you know, we helped it. Do you have any favorite failure? Something that happened that seemed really, really bad, but in the hindsight, that was probably the best thing that could have happened to you?
I had a lot of failures. Favorite ones, I don't know about that. They don't feel very good at the time.
Right. But in the hindsight that, oh, well, I'm glad that happened.
And so I think one kind of a career move, I came out of college, and God, the things you don't know when you come out of college, it's staggering. But I had a very rosy-colored view of what engineers did for a living. And my first job out of college was a train wreck. I was dirty, and it was like working these night shifts in the middle of Maine and this nasty, ugly industry.
And you're not selling engineering well, just so you know.
Oh, and I don't know that this was everybody's first experience, but it was mine, and it was not what I was expecting. It was really not what I was expecting. I was in a sewer at one point, like scraping stuff off of, like, it was just, it was nasty. What am I doing? Oh my God, what a mistake I made. And of course, when you graduate from college, you have no experience. Everybody wants 5 or 10 years of experience. So it was tough after that first kind of bad decision I made around that first job I had to, and so many different options. What do I do next? And how do I find a job? And I didn't know. It took me a while. And I eventually got a different job. Then a couple of steps later, I ended up in engineering and eventually in pharmaceuticals. But my dad always, no experience is a bad experience. I mentioned that before. So at some point many years later, I was working in an engineering firm in an office in a much more genteel environment. And the coffee pot was right around the corner. It was, you know, a lot more.
No dirty clothes.
What I was looking for, that's more what I expected. And I was talking to some design engineers, and I was like the only one in the office who had ever seen a heat exchanger. Oh, like in this case, it was in a refinery. So I was like, you know, you've actually seen one before? Yeah, and they were like, how big is this? I'm kind of waving my arms at, well, you need to leave about this much space around it, because when you pull the cover
off. You're like the guy who shook Sinatra's hand.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So that, at the time, when I was going through the kind of rough experience in the cold, cruel world after college and all that, that definitely would not have been a happy time in my life.
Yeah, it's such a good example.
But
it came in very handy.
Years later, I thought, like, I've actually had hands-on experience that bunches of people didn't. So that was certainly a good one. And I think maybe more recently, because, you know, I'm an old guy now, my perspectives have changed. But I got a blood test late last year that said I was a fat old man.
December 2018.
Yeah, around Christmas time. And doctors said, if you don't change your habits, you're going to develop some, you know, old man diseases, cholesterol, and my sugar was high and that kind of thing. So I went a little bit on off the lunatic deep end. But
we are engineers after all, so.
And that's how I approached it. I got process controls in place and started tracking and monitoring and FMEA analysis, a whole nine yards. But if you had told me at the time, I didn't think I was really all that heavy. I knew I was a little bit overweight, but I didn't think I was that heavy. I still was in decent shape. But if you told me I could have lost 50 pounds, I would have told you were completely insane, that I didn't have 50 pounds to lose. I'd have to cut off organs and legs and all that kind of thing. But it's 8 months later, and I've lost 50 pounds, and my blood sugar is perfectly normal, and my cholesterol is low, in fact.
You're running again?
I'm running again, and generally have lots more energy than I did.
Right. That's an example. So when you got that call from the doctor and you looked at the number, it must have sucked. But eventually, it forced you to make healthy
choices. I was miserable. I was absolutely miserable because I like drinking beer and eating pizza.
Who doesn't?
You know, and I like ice cream. I like all that stuff I shouldn't be eating. So it forced me, part of my lunatic fringe. I always say about the medical profession, there is no owner's manual for the human body.
Right.
So unless you're reacting to, you know, kind of the data and the things that your life is telling you, the end of your life could be pretty damn miserable. So you have to kind of do
a
little bit of experimental learning, what works for you and what doesn't. And I took a very engineering approach to it. I got a blood meter and I started checking my blood sugar all the time. And for the record, I'm not diabetic. but it was the only way I had to learn and really understand what nutrition meant and how it affected my body and how exercise affected my body. And it's still a learning curve. It's a multivariate analysis and it's a little frustrating at times. Sure. But I was angry when they called and said, you're pre-diabetic. And it was not a good thing. I was like, I'll just keep doing what I'm doing and die when I'm 60. I'll deal with that. And of course, it's not how it works. But
we can intellectualize anything.
Yes.
If you like something, you can justify it.
And now, you know, my feet, I'd had some problems from running that we were talking about, but my feet were hurting me at the time. I hadn't run in quite a while. And at some point I said, screw it, I'm just going to start running. And all of a sudden my feet felt better. So a whole bunch of good things happened from that I'll begrudgingly admit that was certainly a good outcome and, you know, a shock that I needed to correct some really bad habits that I developed over a long period of time.
Yeah, you had developed all those habits over a long, long career. Speaking of long career, you have had a long and fulfilling career in the pharma industry. What would you advise to someone who is looking for a long and fulfilling career in the pharma industry, someone who is an aspiring executive, someone who wants to lead a large group of people to work on important projects?
Yeah.
The other ways, and I'll just add, I didn't catch you, but I'll add one more point to that. Knowing what you know now, how would you approach your career differently? I think the answer to what would be same, but I figured
the latter question, and it's another question you get quite a bit, right? So a lot of younger guys will ask you, what would you do differently? And my answer to that is the reality answer. I probably wouldn't do anything differently. And it's not so much that I made every decision right, far from it. But at the time, you make the best decision you have with the information available to you and what's important to you. One of the examples I have, Samir, is probably about 15 years ago, more than that, about 19 years ago. My oldest son had just been born, and we had an opportunity to move to Singapore for a project for, quote unquote, 6 months.
Oh, sounds fun. Newborn baby in Singapore.
Yeah, and I was excited by it. So he came home. Told my wife, like, hey, I was asked if we'd go to Singapore for 6 months and you're working this project. When's the last time you went on a project that was 6 months that it was actually 6 months? I said, well, that doesn't happen. Like, they end up being 2 or 3 years. But I said, Singapore, like, look, think about where it is. We can go to China. We can see the Great Wall. We can go to Thailand and Australia. And I was kind of rattling off all these things we could do.
With a newborn baby,
But that was the key. So I said, our son will be 2 years old and he'll have seen more of the world than most people do in a lifetime. And the sort of thing that got her was, and on the way home, we'll swing by Egypt and see the pyramids. She went off the deep end. Swing by Egypt? You don't swing by Egypt. And she couldn't deal with it. And she said, you know, think of the life that pieces of our life that we're going to miss. Our grandparents are old and we've got a new baby and our parents. But like, she was thinking about it like a mom.
Right.
And
because she was a mom.
Because she was in all of like the family things. And I was thinking about it in terms of the future of our son and like think how cool it would be to show him all this stuff even as a little kid. But we made a decision at that point in time not to go to Singapore and do all those things. If we had gone, who knows what would have happened? I probably wouldn't live in the United States now. Yeah, I'd buy something. Things just move from every decision that you make. But I think you can't get paralyzed about that. We made a decision at that time that it wasn't the right thing for us. Things would have turned out differently. I'm not unhappy with how things turned out now. But I'm a big believer in not thinking too much about that stuff. If it feels right, like if you ask 1,000 questions about what's my title going to be and where am I going to live and how am I, forget it. It's over. You don't want to do it. If it seems right, it generally fits your personality, and you think like, yeah, it's something I might like, just jump and make it happen, because opportunities only come on your radar screen so often.
If it's a good opportunity, there are going to be more than one candidate vying for it.
Right, and if you delay too long, you're gonna miss it. So I say jump, but trying to recreate that series of events that I did would be next to impossible. You said no sometimes, you said yes sometimes, the mix has landed where I am. I wouldn't necessarily change anything. And frankly, in my career, I'm past a point I thought I was going to be. So people ask me, like, what's your next move? I have no idea. Like, I thought I was going to be the head of engineering in a plant somewhere, like installing air handling units for the rest of my career. I've long since passed that point in my career, but I have no idea what the next thing looks like. So you're thinking about a lot of time and quiet moments at night when things kind of settle down and you're able to kind of let your mind wander a little bit. I wonder about that, but I don't know. I'll wait and see, and I won't think too much, and I'll say yes when the next thing comes up.
What are your thoughts? By the way, I totally relate with that thing. You only get opportunity. You are only given opportunity once. And if you don't take it, if opportunity is good, our industry is full of qualified people who are risk takers, and they will jump at any good opportunity. Mm-hmm. So you have to make the most of the opportunity given. What are your thoughts on the new forces in our industry, how it's going to affect the future of the pharma? For example, things like artificial intelligence, wearable technology, analytics, and that sort of things.
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating subject. I'm probably too old to see a lot of that stuff come to fruition.
Oh, you'd be surprised.
It's coming quick. I agree. It is coming quick. But I think the combination of...
I mean, the things you mentioned earlier about your monitoring your own vital statistics, blood, and those things weren't around for, 10 years ago in the form it is right now.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, it's unintrusive and you can do everything on your cell phone. Those things weren't there 10 years
ago. I'll use that as an example, right? And you're right. I think it's going to change a lot faster than I'm thinking in terms of really crazy stuff. But I think it's already changing faster than anyone would have expected. So if you think about diabetes, and it's more about type 1, not type 2, and those are very different animals. So they're not even the same disease, really. They shouldn't be called the same things. But there's now a device that you can stick to your arm. There's a few different manufacturers, and it continuously monitors your blood sugar levels, and it reads out to a phone. You can see real-time graphs. Mm-hmm. So if you're a type 1 diabetic and controlling your diabetes between an upper and lower range is critical, which obviously it is, getting real-time information on that is pretty darn important as compared to doing the finger sticks and the very infrequent data points that gives you. So the degree of control that this wearable is given reads out on a cell phone. So who would have thought a cell phone would have led to that type of thing? My cousin, I was just talking to him over the weekend, had a irregular electrical currents in his heart. I can't remember the medical word for it. So he's got three devices that were put in his chest surgically 3 weeks ago. One's a pacemaker. Another one kind of steadily shocks his heart to maintain a constant heartbeat. And the third device monitors his heart rate and all those other things. It all reads out in his phone. So it's interesting because what that does in and of itself is nothing. The pacemaker and the other device obviously does something, but it's really about training him to live with this condition.
Yeah.
And that's what the stuff around tracking the food that you eat and the macronutrients, if that's more of a soft thing, you've got to enter it all in, but it's training you how to deal with your body and medicine.
And it's also going to save so much time, money, and energy, because if you need to do all those things before 10 years ago, you had to go to the doctors. That means you had to take time off from your work day. You go to doctor, you have to pay some deductible or insurance has to pay. And the doctor has to spend time. He had to spend time to check on you. And now you can do that on phone. Versus the doctor could have attended to some emergency where someone really needed his help and needed look after. So I agree. It's going to change. It's going to have. And these are the subtle changes that it happens so subtly that we don't really think in terms of the tsunami impact it's going to have. We are talking here about hundreds of millions of hours and dollars and, all those savings for the society.
I think all that's coming to, we're at an inflection point, I think, in the industry. Society wants more drugs. They want free. They want now. Better.
Right.
And I just think that the key to all of those sort of societal pulls is going to be something of a technology-driven solution. Wearables and AI definitely a part of it. And that has more to do with human psychology, I think. We want immediate feedback for what we're doing. And if you take a pill for blood pressure medication, you have no idea if that's doing anything or not. So if there's something where you can see the response or you get some kind of positive mental picture of taking the pill just did this healthy thing for me, I think people are much more compliant. And if they see, if I live a different health style, if I exercise more, if I eat certain foods, that's going to also have the same benefit, that it's going to change the dynamic of the healthcare industry from taking a medication to fix an illness to how do I live healthy.
Right. Let's talk about one of your hobbies. You are a brewer, and I don't mean coffee. You brew beer, right?
Yeah, what do you want to talk about?
Yeah, so I hear you got some pretty interesting setup, like a bioreactor. And so tell us about your setup and kind of beers you brew and any lessons that you have learned.
Yeah, so with my health kick, I haven't been brewing so much.
Let's talk about your pre-physical time.
I still have it, though. I haven't given up on the idea completely. But yeah, I started, I don't know, 25 years ago. My brother got into brewing, and I visited him, and we made a batch. It was pretty fun. The beer tasted fantastic, like the best beer I ever had. And the idea that you could sort of manipulate.
And it only cost you pennies, right, since you brewed it yourself.
The kits aren't so cheap, like when you're making it initially at a smaller scale, like a 5-gallon scale. So it's excellent beer, so if you compare quality to quality, it probably is cheaper, but it's not dramatically cheaper. But then I'm an engineer in the pharmaceutical industry, so I'm sort of predisposed to want to, how can I optimize the efficiency, how can I get more out of the time and investment? So over the years, especially working in construction, some things tend to show up here and there that most average people don't have access to. And I get friends, and they taste my beer, and they go, I got this tank at home, like, could you use it? So my brewery grew in scale, little bits and pieces. I learned how to weld stainless along the way because I wanted to make my own fermenter, and that grew, and I got this other thing. But over time, and then you buy a piece, you know, from the internet, which is awesome. You can buy anything you want. So it got to a point where I have batch records. I can brew it.
I was going to ask, please tell me you have batch records and SOPs and checklists.
I have all of that. I've got inline temperature monitoring. I have pump tanks and heat exchangers. I've got in-process controls. And like the most rewarding thing, I have a model. So when I design a batch, there's parameters that you look for that define the quality of beer. And there's a couple of typical ones, the international bitterness units, how bitter the beer tastes is expressed as a number that you derive from the alpha acid content of hops and how long that's in the boil, the specific gravity of the boil. And you have to account for the design of your brewery and how all that ends up in the fermenter. The type of yeast will have certain flavors, the color you can predict through some analytical means, but all these things have to come from online things. But the absolute like happiest I get brewing is when everything winds up after about an 8-hour day of doing all this smashing and weighting and grains and enzymes and heating and cooling. Everything lands in the fermenter. You clean up all this stuff and you take that sample to say, what's my original gravity? And it matches my spreadsheet exactly. And that makes me so happy that all my controls work. And like I started my batch and everything's happy in there. My yeast are cooking away. And it's amazing, Samir, how much you asked before about the mechanical engineer and the transition into biotech. It is absolutely amazing how much I learned from brewing beer. Mm-hmm. That was like knowledge that I gained about how the biotech process worked. It's amazingly similar. I would say actually that making beer, the Egyptians started 3,000 years ago. That was kind of the first biotech industry.
Yeah.
And it was all mystical back then, too. Right. They were all the brewers were special then.
They tasted good, and the after effects were better. So, you know, they kept doing it.
That's right.
Now, I know you are an avid reader. You are a book of flight guy.
Long-haul flights.
Yeah, long-haul flights, and you read books. Tell us about the books that have influenced you or anything interesting you have read lately.
One of the things that you learn as you move through your career and you lead people is that you don't know everything. Right. And, you know, people who have been there and done that and have some experiences and were nice enough to put those experiences down in a book, you can learn an awful lot from.
Oh, I consider books as mentors. When I read a book, particularly autobiography or someone very successful who is writing about a particular aspect of life, I look at a book as a mentor. this is teaching me something.
The founding fathers thought so highly of books, they considered them capital.
Oh, okay.
As in working capital.
Right.
Yeah, the humongous emphasis on books and capturing that knowledge. Big one in terms of leadership style that influenced me was a book by a guy by the name of David Marquette, Turn the Ship Around. A friend of mine suggested it, got it off of Amazon.com.
Mm-hmm.
Really interesting read. The guy was a Navy captain of a submarine.
What era? What time?
Fairly recently.
Okay.
I forget the dates, but say like 90s,
okay.
Late 90s, early 2000s, something
so
like that. Yeah, contemporary.
It's not too contemporary.
And long story short, you're supposed to be the expert of your boat as a captain. Circumstances led to him taking over a submarine that he knew nothing about. And it was the absolute worst submarine in the Navy on mm-hmm. every performance measure. Terrible. In fact, there were pictures and manuals that said, this is a bad submarine and what it looks like. And it was the submarine that he got. So
that's going to suck.
He had, and you can just imagine, I mean, he's sitting there going through the chain of command. The second after the chain of command, he owns that boat. So if that thing goes down 1 second after he became the captain, it's on his military record and he's done. And all these things are going through his head. And I won't give the book away, but essentially the point was that he had to very quickly adapt to a totally different leadership style than what the Navy would train its captains for, which was very procedural and precise. He essentially enabled his crew, created a vision and a culture, and as a leader, he graded himself on the performance of his people, the accomplishments of his people.
Mm.
And that idea of create a vision, get out of that way and help your people be successful was something that resonated a little bit with me anyway. I've never been much of a details guy, but that idea of, you know, and it's one of those things, again, as a technical person, you like details and you want to be the expert on things. So giving that role to somebody else is not something that's easy to do for engineers,
right,
scientists.
Right.
He had to do it out of necessity because it wasn't possible for him to become an expert in his boat. And I'm, like I said, a little bit predisposed to want to do that anyway, but getting the right people in the right jobs, getting a common vision and then getting out of those people's way and let them do it, and help him be successful. I think that's the key. So he gauged his own success by other people's success.
That is such a good message, particularly in our industry where organization is scattered all over the globe. And there are so many criteria to judge a performance. But judging your performance by your team's performance, I think that we all can use that. Matt, thank you so very much for your time.
You're
thank
welcome.
You very much for joining.
Flattering. Glad to do it. Thanks,
yeah,
Samir.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Take care.
Hope you enjoyed today's episode. Be sure to subscribe and let others know. Word of mouth is our oxygen. Visit www.ispeboston.org for the comprehensive show notes from today's episode and also find out more ways to associate with us. Do let us know your thoughts in the comment section, and if there is someone you'd like to see as a guest on this show, thanks again for joining us today. We'll see you next time.